Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. I'd like to begin by saying what a wonderful sight this is, to have everyone gathered together. People have come from far and wide, some obviously living here already, others have come from Chidhurst Monastery, other places around Britain, also from Europe and all the way from the US, to be part of this retreat, to help support it, or to be part of the monastic community, fully engaging in the formal practice this time of 3 months through the winter period. Beginning of a time like this, particularly when it sits on the horizon for a number of weeks or months, the winter retreat up ahead. And for many of us, this is the most delightful and rich time of the year. Certainly for myself, that's always been the case for a long, long time, that it's the time of the year that's most enjoyable, the time for very focused and concerted formal practice, group practice, and the real depths of the spiritual training can be plumbed and explored. So in that respect, and it's probably the same for most of us, and those of you who've also come to help support the retreat, at the beginning of a time like this, that's something that we've been looking forward to, it's been on the calendar for a long time, then it's extremely natural for us to have a feeling of expectation and maybe a sense of hope or anticipation, looking forward to, oh great, fantastic, winter retreat at last. Been looking forward to this for so long, this is great. So we have an expectation, a positive, hopeful feeling, or maybe we have the other side of it, the sense of dread, oh right, 3 months with my mind, an absence of legal distractions, oh dear, it's all coming back to me. Yeah. And a sense of challenge, or a sense of dread, or wondering what this new guy is going to do with leading the retreat, whether it's all going to be different from the way that we're used to, or the way that we like, or what we want. So it's natural to have expectations, what we are looking forward to. That arises quite instinctually, quite ordinarily. The feeling of anticipation, of hope, hoping to develop certain aspects of our practice, hoping to develop more concentration, hoping to develop insight, to explore, to understand Dhamma teachings, the Dhamma practice. But the more the mind is filled up with expectation and hope or fear, then the less able we really are to experience the present moment. And so to say to ourselves, okay, I'll just abandon all expectations, I'll just stop thinking like that. We can't do that. The mind just doesn't respond to commands of that nature. It still will just bubble up with ideas and thoughts, and oh, what about this, and maybe about that, and oh, that was really interesting, oh dear, I hope that doesn't happen. Those things come up on their own. So I would encourage a sense of being ready to acknowledge expectations or hopes or fears that arise, and to see that as normal and natural, but also to make a conscious and directed effort to not buy into those, to not believe in either the positive or the negative, or just the space-filling, planning mind, what I want to do, my plans for the retreat. You're looking at the schedule, looking at the outline for the retreat, then the mind loves to fill up the idea of the future with something, with a hope or a fear or a plan. So just to notice, to observe that tendency, that habit, to see that that's a mental reflex, a compulsion, or a custom, a habitual form of the mind, to see it as that, and to let it go, to do the best one can to see that simply as a mental formation, as a pattern of consciousness, to see it, to feel it, to know it, and to release it, to let it go. Now, when we look at the mind, or certainly if I look at my mind, when the mind drifts towards hope or fear, towards planning or dreading, and those habits, almost invariably, those are affected by self-view. That's why they tend to be dukkha-producing and obstructive or clouding the mind. It's because of the habit of, or the quality of self-view getting woven in there. I think, I want, I hope, I hope it doesn't. I'm going to, I hope I don't have to, I. So that's, that's a natural aspect of it. But because of the element of self-view, then that is directly related to the amount of dukkha, of alienation, of insecurity, of discontent, dissatisfaction that will be experienced. But it's also not the case that we should not be applying any kind of direction or setting any sort of tone for this time. As the retreat begins, then it's helpful, rather than just letting the mind drift into expectation and hope and fear, to rather establish skillful intention. And this, I would suggest, or the way that I handle this or look at this, is to see that intention, when it's skillfully applied, is not related to self-view. It's not coming from an ego. It's not coming from me and mine. But it can be based on Dhamma and directed towards liberation. The Samma Sankappo, right thought or right resolution. This is the second member of the Eightfold Path, and this is the kind of place where it comes in, setting a skillful resolution, a skillful intention, coming from an attunement to Dhamma itself. So that quality of right resolution or right intention, Samma Sankappa, but also the quality of commitment, setting a sense of establishing a sense of commitment to the retreat, the commitment to paying full attention to the practice, to giving one's heart to the effort that is being made to support your own life as a samana, as a monastic, or as a lay practitioner. Commitment to the routine, the commitment to the community consciousness. So these are things I would encourage putting in place, quite consciously at the beginning of a retreat, a sense of wholehearted commitment to really being here, to giving oneself fully to the practice, the training, to the routine, and to the quality of sanghas, to developing a community consciousness, paying attention to how we practice ourselves, and also fitting in with and supporting those with whom we live, our fellow samanas, fellow nuns, monks, anagarikas, anagarikas, and the lay community. Now, in terms of right resolution or right intention, one of the most helpful things, and pretty much every retreat that I've I've led or been teaching on in the last, I don't know, 20 years or however long I've been doing this. One of the things I always like to emphasize is to pick up on one of Ajahn Chah's main themes, which is to set the intention to learn from whatever happens, to let everything teach us. There's one of the collections of Ajahn Chah's Dhamma talks is called Everything is Teaching Us. And that was an extraordinarily common theme. I wasn't with Ajahn Chah that long, just a couple of years in Thailand, and I was mostly at the branch monastery for the Westerners rather than at the main monastery, Wat Bapong, but Lumpur Cha was around a lot and certainly listened to his teachings many times. And as you see, just in what's recorded and reprinted there in the Dhamma books, this is a theme that he picks up on and emphasizes over and over again, that if we are wise, then everything will teach us. But if we're foolish, then, as he said, then even if you're sitting face to face with the Buddha himself, you still won't learn. And this is picking up on a teaching of the Buddha that's found in the Itiwuttaka, one of the shorter collections in the Kudaka Nikaya. The Itiwuttaka, it's called a teaching called the Hem of the Robe. And in this, the Buddha says, if someone were to take hold of the hem, the border of my robe, and follow me around wherever I went, if that person's mind was filled with greed, hatred, and delusion, it would be as if they are far from me, as if they were far, far away and separate from the Tathagata. And yet, conversely, if someone's heart is free from greed, hatred, and delusion, even if they are 100 leagues away, hundreds of miles away, then it's as if they are sitting face to face with the Tathagata himself. So this was a principle that Lumpur Cha would emphasize, that we are in the position of being, it's up to us to be face to face with the Buddha. We can meet the teaching, we can receive wisdom here and now, at any moment, if we are open, if we're paying attention. But if we're filled up with our own views and opinions, our own preoccupations, our own habits, everything is firmly filtered through our own preferred reality monitor, then no matter how perfect the explanations might be, how accurate and helpful the teachings might be, the instructions might be on a conceptual level, we won't learn anything because we're already filled up with our own preoccupations, our own opinions, our own fixed views. So in terms of everything teaching us, what's helpful to establish at the beginning of a retreat like this is to set that clearly in mind, to say whether it's formal practice sitting here in the temple or doing walking meditation up and down in the meadow or at the stupa or in the courtyard or wherever, or whether it's washing the dishes, brushing our teeth, shoveling snow, walking across the yard, whatever it might be, if we pay attention, whatever the activity might be, then we can see the Dhamma, we can be open to the Dhamma, the nature of the way things are, will be revealed to us right there. We can see the truth of the Dhamma, the law of change, the law of unsatisfactoriness, the laws of all Dhammas being not self. It's revealed all the time in a dead leaf on the ground, a cloud forming in the sky, an ache in our tooth. It's always right there. So if we're wise, we'll learn from the formal and from the informal. If we'll learn from what we want, what's desirable, and what's undesirable. We come into the temple and sit down and our mind immediately goes peaceful and quiet, the body relaxes, we find ourselves filled with energy, all the defilements fall away, the mind is focused and bright, and insights bubble up to the surface at regular intervals. Just what we want. This is the stuff. I remember years ago being on a community retreat at Chithurst, and I remember it was before we even had the shrine room fixed up. We were sitting in what's now the reception room, and it was about the fourth or fifth day of the retreat, and it was a mid morning, and the sun was coming through the windows, and my mind had gone strangely quiet and bright. And I remember having this distinct feeling when Lumpur rang the bell at the end of it. This, and I think I even said it out loud. I said, "That's what I want. This is the stuff." You know, you could just feel the mind, you know, taking hold of that. Like, yes, this is the desired object. You know, the bright mind, free of hassles and everything. You know, as we would wish it to be. So we can learn from that. But if we're wise, we'll also learn from the aching body, the restless, crazy, random thinking, the nameless ache in the heart, the unrequited loves, the vengeful resentments. Even if the mind is absolutely filled, cluttered with all kinds of negative and painful activity, that will still teach us. And that will, we can still learn from that if we're wise, because that in itself is not. The Dhamma is still present. There's still those patterns of feeling and thought, perception. Even the most unskillful and difficult, painful, violent, insane, crazy patterns of mental activity, they're still following the laws of nature. They still arise and pass away. They're still they're very obviously unsatisfactory. And they're also not self. So the mind that recognizes that is completely crazy. My mind is absolutely out of control. Look at that. In that moment, we're developing wisdom. In that moment, there's a recognition that the mind's states can be completely out of control, can be completely crazy. And that if we're wise, we'll recognize that which knows the craziness is not crazy. That which knows that unsatisfactoriness is not unsatisfactory, is not limited by that. So if we set this intention to learn from everything, then what that means is that nothing is wasted. You might think, if you have an illness, that, oh dear, this is such a shame, just at the beginning of the winter retreat, and I'm feeling really sick and wretched, this is really inconvenient. This is exactly when I didn't want to get the flu or get the cold or have a wrenched knee or a pulled ligament or a migraine. This is really what I didn't want. And exactly the same way, we can turn even sickness and discomfort to our advantage. We can learn from that. Just that the mind that recognizes this is really inconvenient, this is association with the disliked, is dukkha. This is following the pattern described by the Buddha. This is functioning according to the laws of Dhamma, the laws of nature. It is Dhamma Niyamata. It's functioning according to the law of Dhamma. Look at that. So I strongly encourage the conscious setting of this intention. So then it's not that we're looking for trouble. We're not trying to injure ourselves or get sick or make more problems for ourselves. But by setting this intention, then whatever way things go, whether you have someone snoring loudly in the next room, or you have beautiful, peaceful abiding, whether you are the mind is peaceful and calm and brimming with insight, or whether it's just feeling agitated and unsettled and grief-stricken and critical. Everything will teach us. Everything will be a source of wisdom for us, if we let it. So I would encourage just setting that intention, because even when we lose it, even when we get carried away by some particular pattern of thought that we take to be really true, all sankharas are impermanent and empty, except for this one. This is a real problem. This isn't as empty as the other ones. This is a real issue. This is actually permanent and absolute. And looking at that very feeling, just even when we're sunk in some kind of particular belief or plan or obsession, some kind of anguish, some agitation, some excitement for days and days. Even if the mind is really lost in that, even if it's completely caught up, then when that finally abates, when it finally diminishes somewhat, and you realize, then there's a recognition of, whoa, I was really lost in that one. This seems extremely convincing. Again, just to be able to recognize, look at that. I find this utterly compelling. This seems completely real and important. This is a real problem. That person absolutely should not be the way that he is. Or this anguish that I have is completely unresolvable. That wrongdoing is completely unforgivable. To recognize that's the feeling is solid, this is real. That's the feeling that's here. So even when the mind is really sunk in it, is really lost in it, to even have that degree of mindfulness, to recognize this is a state that's being clung to, this is a state that's being believed in, this is an idea that the mind really, really wants to believe in and hang on to. Look at that. Then in that moment, we're practicing with it. It doesn't necessarily dissolve the belief or take away the pain or remove the weight of it. But the essential thing is it's being understood, it's being seen with the eye of Dhamma, that we're recognizing that this is what's here right now, this is an arisen quality. And so to that degree, we're working with it and we're establishing a mindfulness of it. And to some degree, the heart is being freed from limitation, from being bound and burdened by that. So similarly with just looking at one of the elements of this is that sometimes we find particular areas of our life easy to see in perspective, and say that our criticism of our own mind, or criticism of somebody else, or with the weather, we can say, oh, this is just liking, this is just disliking. I can learn from this. And then other aspects of our experience, we just don't even notice there's a reaction there, and we believe in them completely. But the trick or the great skill is to develop this kind of attitude to all the different areas. So maybe it's easier to see those habits in relationship to criticism of ourselves or others. But then when it comes to something like the routine, you think, yeah, but it really, group practice is really, really good. And that I really don't like to have to practice on my own. I really like to be meditating with others, because that's good. That is good. That is better. And the mind takes that to be true and real. And that, or maybe you have the opposite feeling, like, oh, group practice is such a pain in the neck, and have to endure it for so long. But then, just being able to meditate by myself—that's the best. That's the good stuff. That's what I really like. That's what's really beneficial. And just to expand the attention to encompass those kind of judgments as well. Oh, that's what the mind really likes. That it takes that particular preference and calls it real, calls it absolute. But this too is just another set of formations. It's just another sankhara, another pattern of feeling arising and passing away. This is something that is being relished, is being delighted in, is being invested in, or is being rejected. This is what it feels like. Another of the aspects of Dhamma practice that our teachers, Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Sumedho, have emphasized over the years, and it's in a way related to this sense of being ready and being interested, committed to learning from everything, is because with this attitude, we establish a strong quality of continuity. And this is something that, again, you see over and over again in the teachings, that if we think the real practice is just sitting quietly with our eyes closed in the meditation hall, or walking up and down doing jhongrom, walking meditation, that's the real practice, and the rest is just filler. Or the real practice is the group practice for the first 2 weeks and the last 2 weeks, that's the real stuff, and then the rest is a sort of blank bit in the middle that doesn't really matter. Yeah, then we're missing out. Cultivating an unskillful attitude, or a mistaken attitude, or an attitude that will not benefit us in the long run. Because the continuity of practice means being ready to learn from the formal and the informal, from the times of group practice and times of individual practice. And I'd really like to encourage that a sense of the retreat is 3 months long. It begins this evening and then carries on through until March 31st. And this is a defined span of the retreat, and all of it matters. Well, of course, all of our life matters, and even just creating the conventional span of the winter retreat is an additional framework in its own. And ideally, we sustain the continuity outside of the winter retreat and continuing through on our whole lives. But this is a time to develop that quality of continuity as a skill. This is an opportunity to bring that attitude into being and to sustain that, so that this is a way of recognizing that it all matters. The Dhamma is present, whether we're sitting with our eyes closed or whether we're washing the dishes. The Dhamma is exactly the same. The ultimate reality of things is exactly the same, whether it's through the perceptions of a dish that you're scrubbing with a Brillo pad, or whether it's watching the refined flutterings of the inhalation. Yeah, the Dhamma is the same. Whether the eyes are closed or open, whether the body's moving or not, whether it's a coarse feeling or a fine feeling, the ultimate reality of all things is exactly the same. Similarly, we can suffer in all postures. Dukkha arises whether we're sitting, standing, walking or lying down, whether we're in the Dhamma here in the temple, in formal Dhamma practice, or whether we're straightening out our bedding or brushing our teeth or vacuuming the carpet. Dukkha can arise just as easily. So that when we establish this sense of continuity, or work at sustaining that, then just as dukkha can arise in any posture and at any time, wisdom can arise, right view can be established, can arise, can be brought to bear at any time and in all postures. And so this is an encouragement to establish that a conscious quality of continuity throughout this whole retreat period, whether there's group practice or whether it's an informal time of the day, whether it's a period of time when there's a lot of group practice in the routine, or whether it's an open schedule, whether we have a formal gathering for morning or evening puja, whether we don't. And seeing how it is, sometimes it's really easy, it feels like it's a lot easier to be mindful and to be focused when there's group energy and group support, and then when we're by ourselves or it's an open schedule, then we really fall apart. Well, it's good to see that. It's good to be aware of that. Look what happens when there isn't a structure, a vehicle to carry me along, that everything goes pear-shaped or boneless. This flops completely. Look at that. See how that works. or how we can feel, you know, restricted and confined just because there's a, you know, a schedule of group practice and a bell ringing, and it's supposed to be time to get up, supposed to be time to do walking meditation, supposed to be time to get in the hall and to sit down again. How we can react against or create tension in relationship to a routine. If we're wise, we develop this quality of a continuity of mindfulness, we see, oh look, this is how the mind relates to an openness, an informality of, in the schedule. This is how the mind relates to formality. This is how it relates to structure. This is how it relates to formlessness. Look at that. See how that works. So we get to know our own character. We get to know the way that we relate to form and to formlessness. And through that familiarity, we know what our strengths are. We get to learn what our weaknesses are, how we can direct our attention, our energy, and our efforts in making use of the skills and the disposition that we have, but also developing strengths where we have lacked, or where there's been weakness, or we've found difficulties. And you can see for yourself, and the more that we put the effort into cultivating a quality of continuity, then everything becomes a field of practice, not just sort of within the scope of the winter retreat, but then it's that much easier to sustain it after the retreat is over, and that the rest of the year, when there's more activity and people visiting and engagement, then that quality of mindfulness and that continuity of reflection, the establishment of right view, becomes that much easier, regardless of the circumstances that are being perceived. So with the retreat, part of the structure and the form that we have is practice of noble silence, and this is something I would like to encourage for the monastic community, so that there'll be opportunities for Dhamma discussion, group interviews, and times to ask questions and have time to explore Dhamma topics during the course of the retreat. And then when we don't have an evening talk, my plan is to have a reading each day in the sala if there's not an evening talk that day, with an opportunity to ask questions and have Dhamma dialogue during that situation for those who would like to come along and be part of that. So there'll be opportunities to engage and to discuss Dhamma and to explore that, certainly. But apart from that, for the monastic community, I'd like to strongly encourage a noble silence. So noble silence meaning, you know, if you want to know where the new fresh bags for the vacuum cleaner are, that you don't have to write, where are the Hoover bags? You don't have to write notes to each other, but it's quite okay to speak for ordinary practical tasks like that. But just to refrain from engaging in conversations, in chit-chat, any kind of unnecessary dialogue, but to use the opportunity of this retreat to develop a strong attention on the internal world, to refrain from engaging with others verbally, and to just give yourself that gift of spaciousness, and to give that to others, to allow that to others as well. So that if there is a need or there's something that needs to be discussed, some practical matters, then to find a place either within the vihara or, let's say, in the communal buildings like the morning room or different places in the monks' vihara, nuns' vihara, where things that need to be discussed or sorted out can be talked about, but to be using that need to engage in a skillful way. Also finding a place that's not making a lot of noise with other people's rooms or in the corridors, and so that we're sensitive to the impact that we have upon others with speech. So I'd like to encourage that as strongly as possible. And for the lay support crew, obviously you have many more practical tasks and things to discuss, and so I wouldn't expect that kind of similar restraint for the support team, so you can feel relieved about that. But I would also just think encourage a quality of restraint and care about not just chattering and filling the air with conversations, but just to be taking care of what needs to be looked after, and to be aware of the impact that your conversations and verbal exchange has upon the whole community, and to be alert to that, sensitive to that. And one of the reasons why noble silence is so helpful, is such an important practice, that is encouraged in these retreats. And as people know, like when you do a week-long retreat, a weekend retreat, 10-day retreat at the retreat center, you know, other retreat places, then it's a standard practice of keeping the retreatants keeping silence. And one of the most helpful things is because we create ourselves and we create others so much, so strongly through the realm of speech, that we are, the more that we engage verbally and make that the sort of pattern of relationship, then we're, in a sense, and often quite unconsciously, feeding the quality of self-view, that we become a person, we become Ajahn Amaro, or you know, Ajahn Jayanta, or become, you know, Suvir, or Steve, or Ajahn Bodhipala, you know, that we become people when we engage with others. And you might not get a sense or have a sense of what I mean by this, but it's often the case that we are quite content or quite at ease in ourselves, or not, say, seeing things in terms of I or me or mine. But then when we engage verbally, then we speak from the role that we have in the community or in the world, or speak from the particular function that we have, the job that we have, or the age that we are, or the gender that we are, or the position in the community that we have, that we put on the persona of, and that is natural enough, and we do take care of the functions and roles that we have in the community. But isn't it interesting to see how we become that person, we become that role, and that feeds the habits of sakkaya ditti, of self-view. So to practice noble silence is just taking away some of the fuel for that habit, so we can watch the mental movements towards, yeah, but I'm Ajahn Amaro, or yeah, I'm Ajahn Jayanta, or I am Sister Bodhipala. That you can see that forming, but also it hasn't got so much fuel to burn, and so that it can rise up and fall away. And we can see through that formation, we can see the emptiness of that sankhara that much more easily. Just seeing it as a pattern of thought or feeling. The way that we create ourselves is, and that the habit of that is through believing in our thoughts and buying into those habits of thinking. But this is a really good opportunity to explore that, to see how that works, and that this time of year, the 3 months of the winter retreat, is an ideal opportunity to refrain from the normal patterns of engagement and feeding those ways of creating self and other, and just to leave it alone for a while, and just to see what it's like to not have to perform as a person, just to be blob number 5, row 3, you know, part of the great white snowdrift, you know, the noble snowdrift of Anagarikas and Anagarikas. The brown blobs of the monks and nuns. What a wonderful relief, just to be a collection of over 32 parts, and to not have to perform a particular as a particular personality. is for myself. I find that a relief. Like when I'm at my kuti, I don't have to be Ajahn Amaro. I don't feel like a monk or even a human. You know, that when you're by yourself, you notice that one of the reasons why we enjoy solitude so much is that there is that feeling of relief from having to perform as a person. People say, I really like to be out in nature. What they mean is being out away from other humans and being just in relationship to the world of the ground and the sky and the trees and the land, and not having to engage with others. And because there's a peacefulness and ease that comes when we don't have to be a person to buy into that. And that this is an opportunity to explore that kind of quality of letting go of the perceptions of I and me and mine, just to see that this is a flow of perceptions, of thoughts, of feelings, of physical sensations. It's just the five khandhas, form, feeling, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, coming into being, forming their patterns, doing their thing, dissolving. It's not a person. It's not a personality. It's not a self, or it doesn't belong to a self. And even though we hear these teachings over and over again, and we might be able to explore them more directly in formal practice, in sitting meditation with our eyes closed and still, and doing walking meditation, that clarity of vision is heavily supported by the quality of silence and restraining the faculty of speech and to not be feeding that habit of self-creation in a sort of steady and repetitive way. So I would like to encourage this and to let that be a basic standard that we form, and to develop our sense of communality through our being together in silence, being together with there's a quality of caring and a sense of community that's still there, that doesn't have to be represented by saying good morning or or greeting each other or making comments or discussing things. We can express our care and our affection for each other by not speaking, not engaging, and not hooking up with each other in that way. Now, I'm also conscious that haven't been here at Amravati for a winter retreat since 1994. That was a long time ago. It was a different world, and I realize I'm sort of a new guy who's come in, and I'm conscious of not wanting to just wade in and try and change everything and make it all different. So my effort, my intention is to try and do things and set things up and lead things in a way that is supportive and conducive to the practice, the efforts of everybody gathered here. And so I ask for your forgiveness if I lead things in a clumsy way or in ways that are obstructive or difficult, because I'm also getting used to this particular ship, this particular vehicle. The winter retreats at Abhayagiri, where I've been for the last 15 years, the group of people gathered for the retreat would be about 25 rather than 75. So there's quite a considerably larger number gathered here. So I'm not so used to having a big group. Also, I know there's particular customs and patterns and ways of things of doing things here at Amravati that I'm just haven't got familiar with. So I look forward to, and I hope to get to get to grips with that, to get to know how things are done, and to work with that those established patterns. In in a way, it's a sort of meeting of the style that I'm used to and the style that, that everyone here is used to. And I'm sure we can have an interesting and fruitful meeting of those particular patterns. But my intention and my effort is to try and help to create a fertile and helpful, supportive learning environment. Because as I was saying before, really we teach ourselves, and even though certainly here I am up on the Dhamma seat and I'm in the role of being the teacher for this time, this occasion, this community, and just at the beginning of the evening people took dependence. Certainly on that formal level, I'm in the role of the teacher here and been asked to take over the role of abbot of Amaravati since Lumpur's retirement and so forth, as people know. But what I would see is more particularly is that the role of the teacher is to help catalyze the environment so that all of you, everyone who's gathered, you can teach yourselves. Because again, this is something that Lumpur Cha would emphasize over and over again, is that, and as I was saying earlier in the same talk, that we fundamentally are our own teachers, and that if even if you had the Buddha here himself explaining and expounding on a daily basis, if our mind is already filled with our own preoccupations, we believe in our own opinions, we believe in our own thoughts, and take our own thinking and our own attitudes, our own plans and ideas to be an absolute reality, then we won't learn anything at all. Nothing will benefit us. But it's fundamentally we as individuals who are our own teachers. So if the attitude is more that I want to learn, I want to be changed, I want to understand, I don't see things clearly. What does this moment teach me? What does this experience teach me? What do I learn from this feeling of happiness or unhappiness? This experience of praise or criticism, this feeling of gain or loss, of comfort or discomfort? What's teaching me here? What's to learn from this? What's the Dhamma that's being demonstrated, being displayed here? Then we'll really learn. So I see my effort will be to, what I'd like to offer is just trying to be a catalyst, helping you all to use this situation of the winter retreat and this practice, this period of formal group practice, to be something that you learn from, so that you can be your own teachers, that you use the richness of this environment and the opportunity of silence, of stillness, of serenity, to be making use, full use of that environment, so that you can teach yourselves, and so that the words that I'll say, or the explanations that I give, or the outlines that I present are one part of it, but it's fundamentally up to everyone here to make the effort to learn and to be changed. So it's in that spirit of self-reliance that I think we can really make the best use of the Buddha's teachings. It's recognizing, yeah, it's up to me. It's not a matter of how good or interesting or inspiring the teacher up there might be, but what can I learn? What am I hanging on to here? What have I realized? What have I understood? What have I not understood? Yeah. What am I experiencing here in terms of understanding, of obstruction, of defilement, of insight? What's going on? What's happening here? How am I handling this? What can I learn from this? So that there's a very proactive and engaged quality in the way that we relate to the teaching. It's we realize it's up to us, to each one of us, to make the difference. And it's not just what's coming in from outside, but how we receive it, how we take it in, how we work with it, and how we let that teaching, that understanding transform us. So I'll offer these thoughts for consideration this evening, also in terms of the routine, and also in the spirit of continuity. Then it was suggested that, you know, for this, during this time, that we don't have the usual routine for the observance days, but have where we don't have any group chanting or meditation in the morning, but just through this period, just to have the morning chanting as usual, and group practice through the day on the observance day and the day after the observance day, so that we won't have like a late night vigil for the time being, just to establish a quality of continuity and steadiness of group practice. And so in the morning, everyone is invited to gather here. 5 o'clock, the morning sitting will begin, and then we'll have the chanting at 6 at the end of the morning period. So please feel most welcome to come along. And then also we won't be having the community breakfasts on the observance days for the time of this retreat. But people encourage just to have their breakfast quietly, and so that again we can sustain the quality of our communal practice and silence and internal seclusion. So that's the pattern of things that we have scoped out, and I offer these thoughts, these reflections, and also this structure of the retreat for all of our benefit, and may it all be useful to every one of us here.